morning, everybody, and welcome back to the Damage Report. I'm John Averill. Today is Tuesday, and you never know what you're gonna get when it comes to co-hosts. We got something special for you today, and a docket of Supreme Court related stories for you as well. They're gonna play into his background quite well. Charles F. Coleman Jr. joins us once again. Charles, how's it going?
Good to be here, John. Thank you so much for having me. Always a pleasure.
Always glad to have you here. Very excited to have you on, and particularly talk about some of the topics that we've got. I did want to let people know right off the bat, we aim to teach you at least 2 to 3 things a day. You know, we don't want to go too crazy, but 2 to 3 facts. I have a fact for you. We're going to start off really fast. You may not know, but Charles is on Twitter and you should follow him. Charles, where can they find you?
You can find me on the Twitters at CF Coleman Jr. Again, that's CF Coleman Jr. You can just type in my name, Charles Coleman Jr. and you get it. Really simple, right there, hit that follow button and there you go.
You know what? And I'm gonna be seeing how many people sign on. Come on, everybody. Charles is awesome. Show some support. And in return, we're gonna give you some news. That's what we're gonna do. We got 90 minutes of awesome news for you. Not awesome in that it's good. This is America after all, but it's gonna be interesting. So hold on to your butts. We got that coming for you. Updates on the battle to have a democracy. Most of America is on fire. We're gonna check in with the smoking ruin of the Pacific Northwest. We've got the next phase of QAnon. What do you do when people have been turned off by the label? Well, we'll let you know in just a little bit. And as the headline for the stream says, the Trump org is doing their like last ditch effort to avoid some sort of criminal charges. And then we got a whole bunch more. Congressmen associating with anti-Semites, but I repeat myself anyway. More stuff than just that. So thank you everybody for being here. Please hit the like button, share the stream if you haven't already. And if you wanna send us comments, tweets, concerns, super chats, stuff like that, we'll respond as we go. With all that said, Charles, would you like to jump into the news?
Let's do it.
Let's do it, everybody. I just checked Twitter. You guys are awesome. Thank you.
I did.
Anyway,
they are awesome.
I mean, keep going.
They are awesome. I did.
They are. Yeah. Anyway, okay. With that, now let's go to the news. It wasn't that long ago that the Republicans filibustered the For the People Act because, of course, they were going to do that. They filibustered the bipartisan bill, bipartisan in that both Democrats and Republicans out there across America support it. You just can't get a single Republican senator to support it. So, what's going to happen? Well, Joe Biden is responding by meeting with advisors and experts, figuring out their next step. They put out a statement from the White House saying the president and his staff highlighted ways that the administration will continue working with Congress to pass critical legislation and ramp up engagement with the American people on voting rights. The president also reiterated his unwavering determination to win the fight to protect the sacred right to vote in free and fair elections. He said that he would speak more on the issue this week. That's what he said when it was filibustered, though it's unclear when that's gonna happen. He has said, I'm going to be going around the country making the case to the American people that this isn't just about showing identification or being able to give someone water in line. This is about who is able to judge whether your vote gets counted. But as of right now, and I understand he is starting to travel. Supposedly, I believe he's going to go to Miami. He might do some other trips too. We'll see. Maybe he'll talk about it there. But so far, the response to the filibuster of one of the core pieces of his first term agenda has been super muted. And in response, a lot of activists and progressive politicians have an issue with it. Cliff Albright, who's one of the co-founders of Black Voters Matter, said, they're checking the boxes. They're not acting like we're facing an existential crisis. That's the problem. It's from the top down. And Charles, yeah, so far, I mean, I get that they're not gonna seem super shocked by the filibuster, but they don't seem that aggrieved by it either. It seems like, yeah, okay, maybe we'll get around to it at some point.
You know, John, I tend to agree, and I think that the administration is making a very, very bad miscalculation on how much their sort of, I don't want to call it ineptitude, but their unwillingness to really go hard around this filibuster, even as it may have been expected, is going to play with some of the base that they need to turn out both for midterms and then for, you know, the larger presidential election. I think that they're taking for granted that they're going to be able to just point to Republicans and say, it's their fault. That's why it didn't get done. I mean, you know, we've seen now Merrick Garland and the DOJ get involved in terms of litigating some of this on the court front. I think that that was the smart thing to do. But I also think that the case, in terms of going around the country, the narrative has to be framed properly. Because even for him to say, this is not about IDs, this is about who gets to judge, who gets to participate in democracy. Let's break down that statement first and foremost. The latter part of it, when you're talking about who gets to judge about participating in democracy, is a direct allusion to white nationalism, because it's about the decision around who has access to our processes, who is the civic process of America supposed to work for, and who can participate in that. That is at the core of white nationalist ideology. Call it what it is. Like, be courageous enough to call it what it is. The first part, this is not about IDs, is really a dangerous sort of playing into, I think, GOP narratives and conservative narratives around the ease at which, or the perceived ease at which, people can access the democratic process. People take for granted, especially if you live in a metropolitan area, that these things are not necessarily as inconvenient as other places. If you live in Alabama, for example, there are parts of Alabama where it's 50 miles to the nearest DMV from anyone's house. They don't have an extensive public transportation system, and many people who are residents actually survive on public assistance with state issued IDs. So what happens when those people who work every single day, who already have a state issued ID, are told that their state issue ID that they have on public assistance is no longer good to allow them to vote? They go to work Monday through Friday, the DMV, which is 50 miles away, and they don't drive, you know, is the only place that they can go to get a proper ID. I think framing it in that, in those terms, makes people sort of understand, wow, this is a real issue, as opposed to someone who lives in a city. I live in New York, I can take a bus or a train or walk or take an Uber to the DMV, and I'm there in less than 20 minutes. So I think some of us take for granted that when you talk about or dismiss the notion that, oh, well, this just isn't about ID, so on and so forth, you're already allowing them to frame the narrative in a way that misconstrues it, so that the American public doesn't understand the severity of this problem. And secondly, again, you have to be able to call it what it is. This is white nationalism at its core. But in total, you know, John, I really think that if he is not much more vocal and aggressive about calling out the forces that are pushing against this in a real way, that whole notion of, well, we tried, Republicans stopped it, is not going to be enough for voters.
Yeah, and it shouldn't be. Right. After all they did in the last election. So I want to ask you a couple quick follow-ups about some stuff we've been talking about. So one is, I've seen an attempt to push back specifically against, you just described how in some areas this identification is relatively easy to get, in some it's much more difficult. The Republican response, I don't remember if it was Ted Cruz or Rick Santorum or whoever, they're all basically the same human. They said the idea that only one race has a hard time getting identification is by definition racist. So if you express a concern that some people might be disproportionately inconvenienced by this, that is a racist statement. Is there anything to that?
No. I mean, you know, that's my short answer. And I think the overarching idea is, let's just for a moment, let's just imagine that we are going to accept that statement, at least part of that statement, as being valid, i.e. that, you know, it's not just one group that has a problem getting ID. This doesn't disproportionately affect any particular race. It affects us all, or it affects a number of different people who have difficulty getting ID. Well, in the wake of not having actual evidence of voter fraud or widespread voter fraud, which we have been waiting for literally for years now, since President Obama was running for office, these unfounded claims of voter ID in widespread instances have never ever been substantiated, right? So in the absence of that, why are you making it more difficult for anyone of any race to be able to participate in American democracy?
Yeah.
So even if I accept what you're saying is true, which I do not, for a number of reasons, but even if I accept what you're saying as being true, your overall conclusion is faulty, because you're just basically saying, I'm still okay with this being a harder process for people to access because it's harder for everybody, despite the fact that it's a fundamental tenet of our American democracy. Now, picking apart the actual nuance within the statement, it's also not true, because if you look at the places where there are voter ID laws and are voter ID restrictions, and the places that are disproportionately affected, they are overwhelmingly filled with people of color. They are overwhelmingly with black and brown people. So the statement itself from a factual place is false. And there are a number of structural inequities which further contribute to how, when properly contextualized, it's nonsensical. So yeah, the answer, it's a no all around. And even if it were a yes, why would you want to make it harder for people to vote when there's no evidence that the widespread voter fraud that you're claiming to guard against even exists?
Yeah. Well, I mean, we know why.
Well, right, of course.
Yeah. Okay, so let's zoom out a little bit. So Biden seems to be taking the fact that the For the People Act was filibustered really in stride. He doesn't seem that worried about it. Doesn't really seem like many politicians are that worried about it. I wish that they were a little bit more worried about it. That said, there are some things that are coming up having to do with voting rights that I think we should throw into the mix. I understand that all of this is going to be going on in the during the backdrop of maybe they do something about the For the People Act, maybe they don't. So we know baked into the system since baked into the situation since January in Georgia, Florida, Iowa, Arkansas, and Montana, they've already passed and signed new bills to make voting more difficult in a ton of different insidious ways. Dozens of additional efforts are pending. As Charles pointed out, the Justice Department announced last Friday that it was filing a major voting rights case challenging a sweeping new voting law in Georgia, one of the biggest voting cases the department has filed in recent years. So far it's only challenging that one. Now really fast, Charles, what are your hopes or expectations for that case? Considering the Supreme Court that we have, how hopeful are you that anything they challenge wouldn't just be upheld by the Supreme Court anyway?
Well, here's the thing, John. I mean, a lot of what we're seeing in terms of state legislatures, this is the progeny of Shelby versus Holder. And I can't believe it's been like 15 years since Shelby. This is Shelby versus Holder was a Supreme Court case, or the Supreme Court case during the Obama administration that essentially set the stage to gut the Voting Rights Act and set the stage for all of these pieces of legislation to actually exist. Now, when that decision was written, Justice Roberts essentially said that the restrictions that were created by the Voting Rights Act weren't longer any necessary because the vestiges of discrimination that existed in America that created the need for that no longer existed. I think what we are seeing now certainly speaks differently to that. And so if he's consistent, which the court is supposed to do, and he reexamines his logic there and sees what we're seeing across the country, perhaps he may look at, you know, the entire court for that matter, may reexamine it in a way that says, you know what, maybe we jumped the gun on this whole post-racial idea and it's time to sort of allow for us to revisit the Voting Rights Act, but specifically strike down this Georgia law as being unconstitutional. And what that does is it blows the door open for a number of other challenges in state houses across the country. That may or may not happen. What I will say, because sometimes the court wants to prove itself right. What I will say about that is that the Supreme Court is not last because it's right. It's right because it's last.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. That potential future you sketched out sounds good. We'll have to see. We'll have to see. Yeah, and it is crazy. It's been 15 years, huh? Yeah. Well, the Supreme Court's going to get involved in some other ways as well. We have this case of Brnovich versus the Democratic National Committee that they could potentially rule on, I suppose, any day by the end of the session. Deals with two different issues. First, Arizona's out of precinct policy, which discards ballots cast outside of the voter's designated precinct. Does it violate Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act? The other part is, does Arizona's ballot collection law, which forbids anyone other than the voter, him or herself, from handling a completed early ballot, violate the same section of the VRA or the 15th Amendment? According to SCOTUS blog, during oral arguments back in March, it seemed like a majority of the justices were ready to uphold both of those provisions. So if anyone else helped you with your ballot, it could be discarded. If you happened to be in the wrong precinct, even though you're totally allowed to vote, no one questions that, no one believes it was tampered with anything. It's just, oops, you got confused by this really confusing system. So we're gonna discard your ballot. And I think you can guess what sort of class of people are more likely to be hit by that than others. So apparently, Charles, the SCOTUS is willing to, it's looking like they're willing to uphold both of those. Is that your guess, and how significant would that be? Does that make you think differently potentially about the Georgia situation we were just talking about?
It does, and I find it to be troubling. I mean, I think that ultimately, you know, I'm not entirely convinced that they are going to hold it up. If I had to look at the composition of the court, I'm not as confident as I would like to be, but I'm not immediately deterred. This court, surprisingly enough, has proven itself slightly more moderate than I expected. It's stacked with conservatives, but ultimately a lot of the decisions that have come out have not been as staunchly conservative as I would have expected given their makeup. That leaves me with a scintilla of hope, John. It's not necessarily like this huge ray of light that I'm expecting to see, but what could happen is a decision that doesn't necessarily talk as tough as conservatives that might like, and then ultimately muddies the waters for lawyers because it may provide room on both sides for further argument. That being said, because you know they may see an issue that is ripe or on the horizon, but punt on it because it's not the issue that was squarely put before the court. That being said, in terms of the implications that it could have on the Georgia case, it could be a very serious hurdle or a sort of, I'll say, message or sort of, you know, reading the tea leaves, if you will, around how they intend to approach the Georgia case in terms of their rationale and what they're looking for. Nevertheless, what I will, you know, also comment on is that this entire cloud of, you know, resistance to further engagement of the civic process on behalf of voters has really grown and been fertilized by a huge, huge misinformation campaign. And I think it goes without saying, a lot of people may not, you know, may take this for granted, but I do have to point out to the viewers that a lot of what is happening from the court of public opinion, switching gears for that matter, is the result of people not actually understanding that while these laws may seem facially neutral and while it may seem like a good thing to protect the integrity of democracy, you are ultimately trying to, with these laws, solve for a problem that does not actually exist. And I think that the misinformation that has been put out and promulgated by so many different people on so many different levels, media included at some point, has created the idea that there is such a urgent need to stop so many people from cheating and winning and taking elections and all this other crap that hasn't actually happened. But people don't understand that. And so even in conservative districts, if they're not well informed or they haven't bothered to get media from and information from a variety of sources, they legitimately think black and brown people are out here stuffing ballot boxes with names of dead people and stealing elections.
Yeah.
And so this legislation, like, this is the right thing to do. And at the end of the day, no one or very few people are talking about the fact that this widespread notion of voter fraud is a farce, and it's based on nothing more than a bunch of lies. And I think reframing that narrative would go a very long way in getting people to understand how, not only how unnecessary these laws are, but then when you go and take a step further and you think about who's pushing these laws, because those people who are pushing these laws are very much so informed that these aren't real problems. Then the question becomes, well, then if they're not trying to solve that, what are they trying to do?
Yeah, exactly. There's a couple of different ways that you can potentially win elections, a couple of different ways you could potentially get into power. They're choosing one rather than the other, I think. And you know what, let's make that very clear. This last little bit of extra context I'm gonna throw out there is sort of it's a bit of here's the timeline, basically. We have the For the People Act, which would do a lot of things. One of the things it would do is to stop partisan gerrymandering. You would have to set up some sort of independent commission, not established in DC. All of it would be state level. Some of them would maintain the same independent commissions that they already have. So don't listen to, who was it, Graham? Yeah, Lindsey Graham. So here's the issue. In August, state lawmakers will begin the once per decade process of redrawing US House and other state legislative districts. Procedure Republicans are poised to use to wipe out Democrats' majority in the US House. The For the People Act would curb excessive manipulation of district lines for partisan gain. And if it isn't in place by August, Republicans would be free to freely gerrymander districts. Now, how much should this concern someone? Well, I apologize, I don't remember exactly where I saw it, but there was an analysis done of prospective gerrymandering that could be done this August that showed that fairly easily, without the Republicans having to become any more popular, do any better in the polls, simply through the gerrymandering, they could take control of the House. It's same exact situation from last November. They don't have to pitch any new policy or anything like that. They don't have to make any appeals. If they just maintain the level of support they had in the last election, which did not let them take control of the House and lost them the White House and lost them the Senate, they could take over the House just based off of that. And so that's what's lurking in just a couple of months. But right now, it's President Biden might bring it up on his trip across the US. He might say something. What's up?
I appreciate your context, and I didn't mean to interrupt, but.
No, it's okay.
It brought me, what you were just talking about brought me back to one of the earlier moments on the campaign that I recall where Joe Biden was actually, this is pre-South Carolina, where Joe Biden was actually floundering in the polls. And I remember him talking to the press corps and basically saying that he was the candidate, he was the guy who had enough relationships, enough pull to basically get majority in the House and the Senate. I remember him saying this. And I was like, you know what? That's actually a strong selling point. Why isn't he playing this up more? Why isn't this more a part of his appeal, at least in terms of how he is positioning himself in this conversation? That doesn't make sense. It just bothered me. And as you sort of contextualize or further contextualize the moment that we're in now, I am thinking about the very same thing. This is something that you should be shouting from the rooftops, because for all of the sort of people who align themselves with the Democratic Party, for anyone who considers themselves to be a progressive or a liberal or what have you, one of the things that we are watching and looking at is this notion of having a majority in both houses. And it's like, yeah. So what are you gonna do with that? And if you're talking about a situation where you could potentially lose that because of this filibuster and what's going on, so on and so forth, it just adds such rich and important context to voters who are paying attention, that it almost serves to make the case for you so that you don't have to necessarily go as hard. I mean, you should, but you don't necessarily have to go as hard, because now you're talking to people about things that they can relate to and that matter to them. And it just, for the life of me, I can't understand why he has this sort of, as it was said earlier, check the box mentality. Like, who? Let's be honest here. Who are you trying to save face in front of? Who are you worried about offending?
I don't know. Mitch McConnell?
I can't understand. Like, who is it that you are trying to play nice with in the sandbox? You're the president of the United States, my guy. Like, figure it out. So, and again, I just don't, for all the sensibilities that are supposedly involved in politics and all the civility that is necessary in order to make Washington function somewhat, I still can't understand why, being in that space, you're not for something that is a hallmark of your first term in office and will have very serious implications on A, whoever does run for president 3 years from now, and B, whether that person actually is going to be able to win, and then C, what kind of chambers of Congress you're handing over to them. I don't understand why you wouldn't make this a central part of your narrative.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that you're right. He wanted to be president and he's gonna be president for like a couple more months. Will he use it? Stay tuned. Anyway, okay, we are gonna take our first break. When we come back, the heat wave is devastating the West Coast right now. We're gonna give you details on that and a bit of a look ahead to what might be coming to the East Coast. So stay tuned for that. We're gonna read some of your comments, respond to them after this. Okay, everybody, let's jump back into it. The predicted heat wave is now several days in, and it's bad all over the place, all over America, but the Pacific Northwest in particular has had it rough, and it's had it rough for a couple of different reasons. It's really an intersection of weather and climate, both of those things. And I know it's gonna be hard for the media, especially the right-wing media, to understand those two different things. We're gonna try to jump in a little bit. So first of all, it's a highly unusual weathered pattern that's currently in place over the Pacific Northwest. There's a record strong high pressure area known as a heat dome sitting over Washington State and British Columbia. This heat dome is yielding temperature departures from an average of between 25 to 50 degrees. So what that means is in any given spot, it might be 25 to 50 degrees hotter than it would otherwise be. And you can see that visualized in this heat map, which looks like the end of the world because it might be. Not necessarily today, but this is what it's like now. You know, we're always like, oh my God, 2050 is gonna be rough. 2075, Jesus, 2100, what's it gonna be like? What's Wednesday gonna be like, honestly? So yeah, you can see, let's bring up the heat map again. Like I can see a little bit of 35 above what it's supposed to be, a little bit of 36 above what it's supposed to be. Now, what does that look like for major cities where tons of people live? Well, Seattle surpassed its record, which was set on Sunday by 4 degrees when it hit 108 degrees on Monday. A different report said 111 degrees in Seattle. Portland hit its third consecutive record day, an all-time high of 116 degrees. And the Canadian town of Lytton, I apologize, Canada, don't hate me, set a new national record for the second straight day when it hit 118.2 degrees. And so simultaneously, I believe based on what I read, the highest land temperature recorded in Canada. And as an example, in I think it's a Seattle's airport, it was 110 degrees. Normally, the high, the expected high there would be 73 degrees. I cannot stress how big of a difference there is between 73 degrees and 111 degrees. We're gonna show you the difference in terms of infrastructure, because this is infrastructure week after all. But first, Charles, what do you think about this heat dome? It's really something.
I think conservatives have missed the boat, and let me explain why. This was the perfect opportunity to break out the Biden is sending America to hell in a handbasket. This was the week that they were able to actually say, you see, the end is near, we're burning up because of Biden. And you know, this is God's, I mean, they have no problem invoking God to promote everything from slavery to segregation to anti-gay marriage and everything else. Why stop now? Just like this was, that's what I think. I think it's hot as hell. And I think that people would probably, you know, just even that, like you went for make America great. So why wouldn't they go for it? It's hot as hell, vote Republican. Like I just don't understand how they missed the boat on this as a perfect slogan and marketing opportunity in order to sort of, you know, show that America is literally going to hell in a handbasket, or at least it feels like.
You know, I think Newsmax said something about it's hot as Hades. So they're not willing to go to the biblical hell yet, but they're getting into mythology.
Going to Greek mythology, which, you know, is at least somewhere on the progressive chain.
Yeah.
All jokes.
It's like Mordor up in here.
right.
Then exactly. Maybe they'll do that.
All jokes aside, you know, I think that for people who are just super resistant to science, in fact, you can't ignore like what we're dealing with. And this is not just regular hot, it's not regular heat. I want to say Seattle apparently had never had back-to-back 100 plus degree days ever. And now they've had three in a row. You have to sort of look at climate and what that means. And I mean, granted, I get it. If you're a Republican from a state like Texas, Alabama, Florida, Mississippi, Louisiana, you're used to sort of this heat and you're like, what's the big deal? But properly contextualized, these places are not supposed to get this hot. And you can't just say, oh, it's the weather. We can't do anything about the weather. Because as you said, yes, it is the weather and that is part of it. But it's also climate. Like, yeah, we are not supposed to get this hot. And the fact that we have progressively gotten going further and further and further in this space should prompt us to ask the question, all right, is there something we can do about this to potentially alleviate that? Or are we just going to, you know, burn ourselves out quite literally with the way that we continue to live our lives? My prediction, yeah, John, is that it's not gonna get real for people until power grids start failing. I think
We've had a bit of it.
Yeah, I think the more and more power grids start failing and people don't have the ability to go to a cooling center or to go or to remain in their house and remain cool, then people are gonna be like, wait a minute, what in the F is going on around here? Like, that's gonna be
Maybe. And we might be experiencing that. I mean, Texas is still gonna have a tough period. There's sections of California here down in Southern California that might have trouble with that coming up. It's also possible that it could happen up in the Pacific Northwest, because as thankfully a lot of people in the chat have been noting, including RC Tycoon. The thing about it being way hotter in areas where it's never that hot is the infrastructure is not set up for that heat. And that can come in many different forms. One of which is you don't tend to have AC in areas where you don't really need AC. And if you do, it's not gonna be evenly distributed. Like working class poor people are not going to have AC to the same degree as the wealthy. And so when a heat wave like this strikes something like Portland and Seattle, it doesn't strike everybody equally. And we're sort of joking around in the same way that I had to joke, you know, month after month with the pandemic, because the alternative is just to cry on air and we're not supposed to do that. It's in my contract. But this is very serious. People die from heat waves. All, like, everywhere. It happens all the time. It's only going to get worse and worse. People will die as a result of this, and it's going to hit poor people more.
Really quickly, John, to your point, I didn't know this, but heat-related illnesses are the number one related cause, the number one weather-related cause of death in America. I did not know. Like,
that's interesting.
Not hypothermia, not, you know, like it's heat cause or heat-related illnesses, heat stroke, and all kinds of other things. So when you tell and you say to viewers, people will die, you're not fear mongering, nor are you making this up. It's an actual thing, like it's a real thing.
It is. Bit of a fact check there. I think it was Jennifer Brown in the YouTube chat said that Hades is mythologically supposed to be quite cold. Tell it to Newsmax. They don't do their reading. That's the problem. Anyway, but in terms of infrastructure, it's not just that, like, for instance, they don't have places for people to cool down, and the power grid might not be set for AC to be used in the places that do. It's also this in Portland. The streetcar had to go down because their power cables melted. Because they're not supposed to be in heat like that. So generators and stuff like that, everything is set up for a particular range of temperatures, including roads. So State Route 544 had to be closed because the asphalt roadway buckled and broke. And you can find this in multiple different areas of the Pacific Northwest. Photos are going around. Their streets are literally failing because of it. And God help you if you have to walk on some of these streets, by the way. And so this is a disaster. It's not 75 years in the future. It's happening right now. It is part weather, yes, but it's part climate. And by the way, those two things aren't independent either, because high pressure areas like this heat dome are not going to happen the same rate in a world that's 2 degrees Celsius cooler as it is right now. So that is also being affected by this. And thankfully, I think the media is doing a little bit better of a job. I've read that something like 27% of the major news networks coverage segments about the heat wave mentioned climate. That's way higher than we've had in the past. It is still a small minority of the total amount of coverage. So just bear that in mind. Now, I want to very briefly go into one more climate related story just because I found it fascinating. It's a bit more of an evergreen thing, but let's jump into this. Long term, what is going to happen as the climate continues to get hotter, as the ocean level continues to rise? Well, some places are going to be hit earlier than others. And so the Florida Keys, that's an area that is going to be devastated, and it's not that long in the future. And they're starting to prepare for it, but their preparation seems still to be a little bit out of scale with what's going to happen. So Monroe County officials had this 7-hour meeting back on Monday about this. They agreed to push ahead with a plan to elevate streets throughout the Keys to keep them from perpetual flooding, but they admitted that they don't have the money to do so. They need something like $1.8 billion over the next 25 years to raise 150 miles of the roads in the Keys, to add more drains and pump stations and vegetation to absorb the seawater. The thing is, their county budget's not going to be able to cover the cost of all of those. And if they have to do a mass buyout of homes, which is definitely going to happen, these places are not going to be habitable. They're not going to be able to do that either. So they wanted Florida state lawmakers to levy a new tax to pay for it, but Florida state said, no, we're not going to do that. We're not interested. And so right now, if the funding isn't found, there are going to be a lot of roads that you won't be able to traverse. There's going to be homes you won't be able to live in. And all of this, by the way, this is just a brief little fix. They're going to elevate those roads. They're going to move some people, but that does not solve the problem. They will later have to abandon those roads, even if they elevate them. The people they move, if they don't move them far enough, are going to have to move again, and more homes will need to be cleared away. So you're starting to see areas in Florida, the lower lying areas, kind of starting to acknowledge what's happening, but not really understanding the scope of this thing. And you have no assist coming from the Florida state government because they don't even want to pretend that they get how bad this is going to be. Charlie, anything about this?
I think that these things are not as relevant to folks until they start to happen. The sense of urgency is what is going to dictate people's willingness to action. And I think in part, there are a few things that have really fueled the resistance to the climate change movement in terms of people not wanting to acknowledge the severity. Number one, misinformation and ignorance, right? Like, people are just not informed at the level and to the degree that they need to be in order to make decisions around it. And number two, people are really like, so when's this gonna happen? I don't know if I'll be around then. I'll be all right. And so when it comes to, you know, when it comes to like making decisions that are uncomfortable or difficult in the present, to stave off what could or might happen with your mumbo jumbo wizardry science in the future, people will tend to sort of err on, well, we want to spend that money on this now because it's something that, you know, we can reach and touch as opposed to something that may be 30, 40, 50 years off, even though now we're at 30, 40, 50 years from when people began to see this. And then the other thing is like, you know, I say this in jest kind of, but it's actually a real thing. On a certain level, like, entertainment has skewed our idea around how these happen. Like, how many sort of weather climate movies have we seen where Morgan Freeman is the president and then like New York City freezes over? I know that was specifically one movie, but you know, the perfect storm, the day after tomorrow, there is no tomorrow. I don't know.
2012.
Yeah, I don't know these titles, but I think people sort of process even a small part of them, even though it's a movie, like if it's not a cataclysmic event, by the way, I don't know how much more cataclysmic you want than a heat storm that is literally buckling streets in the Pacific Northwest. But putting that aside, if it's not like a cataclysmic event, I think people sort of undervalue the urgency of it and the severity of it because they feel like we can put it off. But we're at the point that you cannot keep kicking the can down the road.
Yeah, yeah, 100%. Yeah, it might not be as sexy as the movies. And it doesn't work exactly like you think. Like, we talk about sea level rise, and I think people think it's like, oh, the street's here, the river's here, you're good, or the ocean's here. And then it goes up, and then, oh no, it's getting close. Oh, now it's not habitable. That's not how it works at all. It's the storm hits you worse, and next year it hits you even worse, and then worse the next year, and it devastates you the next year. And that is long before it literally is above the street. And that is already happening. So Florida, like, get it together. The localities, the state, they're gonna need federal aid. This is a massive effort. We're going to need to evacuate millions and millions of people. But so far, people are just sticking their head in the rapidly moistening ground and pretending that none of this is happening. Okay, we're gonna take our second break. When we come back, a lot more to get to. Okay, let's jump into something weird. We're gonna start off with this video.
God's about to bring the whole house down, ladies and gentlemen. These bunch of sex trafficking mongrels are about to be exposed. These bunch of pedophiles in Hollywood are gonna be exposed for who they are. I don't care what you think about fraudulent Sleepy Joe. He's a sex trafficking, demon possessed mongrel. He's of the left. He ain't no better than the Pope and Oprah Winfrey and Tom Hanks and the rest of that wicked crowd. God is gonna bring the whole house down.
I don't like the words he's using, but I'm excited about it. He's really excited, and he's like, it's Oprah and it's the Pope and they're comparable in some way. And Tom Hanks, you know about the Tom Hanks. Wait, what was all that about? So there's a little bit of Biden's fraudulent. There's a little bit of sex trafficking and demons. To Charles' point earlier, you could really tie in. It's really hot. Maybe it's because of that demon president we've got. But anyway, what you're seeing there is right-wing pastor Greg Locke. But what he had to say had very little to do explicitly with religion, with any religion. Almost all of what he had to say there was effectively QAnon stuff. That's what it was. But you'll note he didn't mention QAnon. He didn't mention Q in any way. So what I want to talk about here is what a lot of people are saying is the next phase of QAnon, which is the QAnon without the Q and without the non. But all of the mythology remains. They're still, see, we have the Q, but they don't. Note that. It's still they're trafficking children. It's still like their weird obsession with people like Tom Hanks. That's really what sells it. Why Tom Hanks? Well, because QAnon thinks that Tom Hanks is trafficking children. There's still going to be retribution. Now, Greg Locke flavors it as God is going to come down on all these people. Traditional old recipe QAnon was somehow the military is going to come in and kill all the Democrats. But it's all about all of the elites that you don't like are trafficking children. They're raping children, and at some point there's gonna be some sort of retribution and they're all gonna die. But we're not saying Q anymore, so you can't ban us from YouTube, I guess. Charles, what do you think about this?
I think it's too hot and it's melting people's brains. This is very, very beyond sad. It's very disconcerting. Like, it's almost like bizarro RPG. Like people playing like a role play game and to step out of that bizarro land universe. I think that there are people who simply cannot accept and embrace, not even embrace, because that's probably asking far too much, but they cannot accept the reality of America as it is. They cannot accept that the reality of what it is that they thought that they knew, believed in, or wanted, that made them comfortable, that they grew up on, that they know, that has allowed them to exist without much constraint or limit, has changed and continues to change and is being challenged in ways substantively that have not been before. And so instead of existing in that reality, it's easier for them, and I say this quite seriously, to sort of cling to these notions that explain why all of this is happening, mm-hmm. and make it something that they can continue to resist. And they've done it for so long that at this point they're so deep down the rabbit hole that to admit that they were wrong leaves them in a space of, well, if all of that was a farce, if all of that was a joke, if I believed in all of that, what does that say?
Yeah.
Leave me. What is my actual reality? So I think, unfortunately, what it boils down to is that a bunch of these folks, if you looked at who was in the audience there, you didn't see much diversity.
That's true. It,
right? So like a bunch of folks are looking at the way that things around us are changing. They don't like it. That is a reality that they want to reject. So it's easier for them to come up with all these cockamamie stories and plot twists and, you know, lines of reason that don't make any sense or go anywhere or have any actual support as an alternative to the current reality, because they're just not comfortable. And yeah. I think it's actually relatively sad that someone would be that uncomfortable with reality that they would make up one to live in. But
yeah, and look, I think that that's very common. The thing that bothers me is that there's so many people that are ready to pounce on those. The millions and millions of Americans that have reached this level of psychological and emotional fragility that they cannot accept any more bad news, basically. Like it's avoidance of cognitive dissonance, basically. Like I believe that this was going to happen. This didn't happen. That hurts. No way. It did happen somehow. That's easier somehow. And the need for things to be simplified, that I can't oppose Joe Biden because he's going to raise the corporate tax rate theoretically by a couple percentage points, which he isn't going to do. But let's say that's a reason to oppose him. That's not good enough. I have to oppose him because he is the literal devil. That's easier. It doesn't require as much thought and all of that. It has to be simple and it has to be what I want. And that's what you have with QAnon. That's what you have now. And this is sort of the Christian version of it. There's other versions too. Now, I want to play a little bit more of his video, and then we've got a poll for you because I'm curious what people think about this. So here's a bit more of Greg Locke.
Do you really think it's that much of an epidemic? Do you honestly believe, we're going to get somewhere crazy. Do you honestly believe, Pastor Locke, that the military uncovered tunnels beneath the Capitol building and beneath the White House and in the Five-Fingered Lakes? Do you really believe that they found kids? Yeah, both live ones and dead ones. And if you disagree with that, and if you try to discount that, and if you try to cover that, and if you try to keep that on the DL, you're just as complicit as Hunter Biden and the rest of them bunch of crack-smoking perverts.
Okay, so if you're watching that and you're terrified about the sex trafficking, if anyone tries to save you from this misinformation, they're as bad as the perverts. So this is a grifter. That's all he's doing, is he's grifting and he's trying to inoculate the people listening to him, not against COVID. That's something that the devil is trying to do to you. Inoculate them against any appeal to reason or sanity. Those are as bad as the pedophiles. And it's sad and it's evolving. We're gonna occasionally check in because you need to know that it's out there. Just because you don't see Q in people's social media doesn't mean this thing is dead. Now, really fast, we do have a poll. Let's bring that up. I wanna see what y'all think about this. So who is most likely to have kids in their basement? Because I wanna give him a real chance at his theory. Is it Joe Biden? Is it Tom Hanks? Is it Oprah Winfrey? Or is it Brett Ehrlich? You can go to tyt.com/polls and let us know.
I didn't make the list. Are we?
That's true. No, they don't mind that. They're okay with Matt Gaetz. They don't mind Jeffrey Epstein and his connections to Republican politicians. They don't care about the actual stuff. But I just, you know, because he didn't put enough names for us to fill the list. So we had to fill it in and we just put the things that seemed most reasonable. So tyt.com/polls. We're gonna do the results on the show tomorrow. Any final thoughts? We got like 20 seconds more, Charles, on QAnon's evolution.
I just think that like this is really a dividing line between the haves and have not. And what I mean by the haves, I mean it has a modicum of sense and those who do not, because at the end of the day, everyone on the QAnon piece is consistently talking about what is about to happen. It's about to, it is about to be blown off of this. Everything's about to be revealed. And we've been waiting for this big reveal. And guess what, QAnon? It's just not coming. At what point
That's
do you
true.
Try to back it up?
Yeah. Maybe someday. But we're not there yet, unfortunately. Okay, we have got a lot more news to get to. Thank you to our linear audience for Twitch and YouTube. We've got some more coming up after this. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.